dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. You've repeatedly heard about Saddam Hussein's rape rooms. On the program this week in our first hour, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh gives us a preview of what he will be bringing out on George Bush's rape rooms in U.S.-run prisons in Iraq. And we'll look at how activists from the 9/11 Truth Movement are working to break the information blockade on the questions of other U.S. government high crimes. Investigative journalist Seymour Hersh's career has included breaking the story of U.S. war crimes in Vietnam, and now in the U.S. military prisons in Iraq. "It's worse than you think," said Hersh at the National Convention of the American Civil Liberties Union in San Francisco, where he spoke on July 7th.
And tonight, we have yet another sterling journalist, one who's dedicated his entire life to shining the truth on shrouded events. That gentleman, as you all know, is Seymour Hersh. Mr. Hersh first gained worldwide recognition in 1969 for exposing the My Lai massacre and its cover-up during the Vietnam War, for which he received the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. His 1983 book, The Price of Power, Kissinger in the Nixon White House, won him the National Book Critics Circle Award and the LA Times Book Prize in Biography. He has 7 other equally notable books to his credits. I think I've read 6. Mr. Hersh contributes regularly to The New Yorker on military and security matters. And earlier this year, an article investigated exactly how Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld circumvented the normal intelligence analysis function of the CIA in their quest to make a case for the 2003 invasion of Iraq. His coverage of Richard Perle in another article led Perle to say that Hersh was, quote, the closest thing American journalism has to a terrorist. And then Mr. Perle threatened to sue him. And this past May, of course, we all know that Mr. Hersh and The New Yorker were the courageous ones who were the first to publish a series of articles describing and showing the photos of torture by U.S. military police of prisoners at the Iraqi prison of Abu Ghraib. Of the school that the story is more important than me in journalism, Mr. Hersh declined to be interviewed last month upon receiving the 2004 National Magazine Award for Public Interest. "Oh my God, this is so tedious," he told the Washington Post reporter who asked about his personal background in 2001. He said, it doesn't have the F word, but it's one of the other words. He said, "What the hell does it have to do with anything I write?" said Mr. Hersh. That's why he's taking the time to join us here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Seymour Hersh, a living legend.
You know, The truth is, and let me know if you have trouble with me in the mic. The truth is that, I don't know how you'll do it, but try. The truth is, it's so ironic listening to John Sayles. I was thinking, I was thinking that the best information we may get about this election may come from a combination of Control Room, Fahrenheit 9/11, John Sayles, the nightly news from John Stewart, if some of you watch that. At the height of the prisoner abuse stories, he had as one of his mock news broadcasters say very seriously to the camera on the Stewart show, he said, "The important thing is not that we commit torture and abuses, is that we're a country that doesn't condone torture and abuses." That's what's a wonderful line. And so you start talking about failures of communication. I don't know where we're going to go with this. I can't make you feel happy about where we are. We've got a very important election coming up, probably the most important since, 1860? I think it is. And there's nothing I can say to you about any of that. I can tell you, I was thinking earlier that in the height of all this stuff, you know, we do live with humor in America, dark humor. Philip Roth sent an email to David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker. In the midst, I think there were three stories we wrote about all this terrible stuff that's going on. And he said, 2 points he wanted to make. He said, one, he said they're great stories. And two, he said, there's some pictures of photographs of me and my girlfriend perhaps you guys might want to publish. Only he. So here we are. The bottom line is, by the way, I'm in a tough position because I'm not done reporting on all this. And so we're going to do some questions, and as long as you give me, because, everybody, you don't want to hear too much of this stuff, but I'll do questions. I'll just tell you what's on my mind. It's a tough position because there is more to the story. And I'll tell you the simple way. I guess the way to describe how you look at things is, I don't know about you, but I have a wife and children, and one of the things that makes life livable is trusting in my partner and never lying to my children and never wanting my children, with the exception of teenage girls, to lie to me about anything. I did echo those comments earlier about children and parenting, but anyway. But basically, you know what I'm talking about. It's the core of how we exist. The way we live, not us, there's nothing special about us. Everybody in the world, we all live. The most important thing in our life is our family structure and the integrity with which we live and the honesty with which we conduct our life and the trust with which we have people. And if you think about it, you begin to understand the bad bargain we have. It's a condition, a requirement, that one we so desperately live in our own families with that we don't even begin to levy on the President of the United States and the National Security Advisor. It's not even a requirement. We don't even have any expectation that they're going to have the same trust and integrity in conducting their affairs as we do in our own personal life. It's a bad bargain for us in the Commonwealth. We don't even begin. We understand what they are. And you heard talking about Henry Kissinger, who, for all of his genius, lied like most of us breathe. And there, when you're in a situation like that, is that partisan or nonpartisan? I don't know. But but you don't begin, you know, it's really a bad bargain. And we live with it pretty happily. We go along, okay, another president, another national security advisor, Condi Rice in this case. And we know we don't get the story. And what do they have the right to do? They have the right to send our children, men and women now, in the name of democracy, to go kill and be killed and to torture. And perhaps be tortured in return, which is always going to be the end result of torture. I think there's nothing wrong with holding these people to the highest possible standards. It doesn't happen enough, but that's what we have to do. We don't know. I'll tell you right now, the reason I'm saying all that is what happened in Abu Ghraib. I can just tell you this, and I've got to do the reporting on this, and you have to wait for me to do it. But it's not about an academic debate in long essays between the Justice Department and the White House, legal essays about where the Geneva Convention ends and the presidential prerogative begins. What we had was a series of massive crimes, criminal activity by the president and the vice president, by this administration, anyway. I can say that. I can't say who did it. The only way to look at this is as war crimes. What happened there are war crimes. And, well, I'm not saying it's there yet. It's not there yet, but that's where it has to go. We have to stop looking at it as some sort of an academic debate about the Geneva Convention and really begin to look at it in terms of who did what, who died, why did he die, are there people missing? Are we doing what the Brazilians and Argentinians did back two or three decades ago, and actually into this decade? Are we disappearing people? Are there people being tortured knowingly in advance that the torture was going to put their lives at peril, and is nothing being done to relieve their suffering and to the point that they die? Is there mens rea? Is there guilty knowledge? Is it a crime? And we're going to get there, because I think that's where it's sort of ineluctably going, as you just see on and on and on. And we're not there yet, and I'm not sure. I'm not telling you I can take it there. I'm just telling you that that's the way you have to look at it. You have to look at it. And so the yipping, and, you know, I'll tell you what an Israeli told me. And the Israelis, as you know, as a very tough, hard-nosed Israeli told me at one point about all this, he said, you know, we hate the Arabs. This is a guy who spent his career in the intelligence service, and, you know, his hands are bloody. He said, we hate the Arabs, and the Arabs hate us. And before 1948, we've been killing Arabs, and they've been killing us. But I have to tell you something, he said. We know somewhere down the line we're going to have to live with these people as much as we can't stand them. They're going to have to be our neighbors. And if we had done in our prisons to the Arabs what you have done to the Arabs in your prisons, we couldn't live that way. And so the bottom line is, we have started something that we don't know the end. The bottom line is about this treatment, and as more details come out, and I can tell you it was much worse, and the government knows it's much worse than they've even told you. There are worse photos, worse videotapes, worse events. To the New Yorker's credit, we decided not for censorship, but just because how much can you levy on Arab manhood in public? But Arabs, I will tell you, it's not just the radicals. And we all know how this administration's policies in Afghanistan, too, and also, of course, in Iraq, has really done exactly the contrary of what they said they were going to do. They haven't ended the war of terrorism. They've expanded it. There's nothing obvious. That's totally clear. But Arabs now, moderate Arabs that normally would be doing the kind of, as you know, the overwhelming, vastly overwhelming percentage of Arabs deplored what happened to this country in 9/11 as much as anybody here. But those Arabs we've lost. They see us as a sexually perverse society. The sexual stuff we did to them is seen as just perversion. And I think we're going to have consequences for a long time to come. There's an awful lot of respect in the Arab world for Americans. I travel there all the time. And American Jews, even. I wouldn't walk around Baghdad. But most of the world is very safe. We have a lot of problems. So rather than deal with the obvious stuff about Bush and this election and what it means, I think the real question we have to answer, and this is the question I don't have, I'm inchoate about it, I don't have an answer. My friend Dan Ellsberg would say heuristic. I have some heuristic thoughts about it. He's a great expert in heurism. And what is the question we have to say to ourselves is, okay, so here's what happens. A bunch of guys, 8 or 9 neoconservatives, cultists, not Charles Manson cultists, but cultists, get in. And it's not, with all due respect to Michael Moore, and you read his movie's fine, but it's not about oil. It's not even about protecting Israel. It's about a utopia they have. It's about an idea they have. Not only about that democracy can be spread. In a sense, I would say Paul Wolfowitz is the greatest Trotskyite of our time. He believes in a permanent revolution, and in the Middle East to begin, needless to say. And so you have a bunch of people who have been, for 10, 12 years, have been fantasizing since the 1991 Gulf War on the way to resolve problems. And, of course, there would be beneficiary. Israel would be a beneficiary, et cetera, et cetera. But the world, in their eyes, this was utopia. And so they got together this small group of cultists. And how did they do it? They did do it. They've taken the government over. And what's amazing to me, and what really is troubling, is how fragile our democracy is. Look what happened to us. We all heard tonight, all of our speakers, directly and indirectly, certainly in the sales movie, about the press and how it's the word, John Sayles used the word self-censorship, which is the beacon word for me. I always think it comes more from, there is a corporate mentality out there, but there's also a tremendous amount of self-censorship among the press. It's like a disease. But also, they not only they took away the edge from the press, they also muzzled the bureaucracy, they muzzled the military, they muzzled the Congress, and it's an amazing feat. We're supposed to be a democratic society, and all of those areas of our democracy bowed and scraped to this group of neocons who advocated a policy. You know what? We all know the story that how mad they got at General Shinseki, who I think is going to run for the Senate in Hawaii and should for Inouye's seat. He's a great general. The important thing about Shinseki to me, and this is just heuristic, I don't know this. The important thing about Shinseki is this. He testifies before the Gulf War, we're going to need a couple hundred thousand troops, and everybody, and Wolfowitz and the others, I count Wolfowitz, I lead with him because he's the genius in the background. He's the man with a great, very articulate, very persuasive. And so Shinseki testifies, we need a couple hundred thousand, and everybody's mad at him. It's about 2 weeks before the war. And it made sense, everybody said. They were mad because he's talking about numbers that these guys say you won't need. They're going to go invade Iraq, and you know the story. They were greeted with flowers and all that stuff. We all know that story. But it wasn't that. Their complaint with Shinseki was really much more interesting. It was, didn't he get it? Didn't he know we've been talking about in the tank with the JCS and the generals? Didn't he get it? We could do it with 5,000 troops. We have to make these bargains with these crazy Clintonized generals. I'm talking like Rummy Rumsfeld would talk. These generals who are these soft generals, literally, unfortunately. These Clintonized generals. Didn't Shinseki get it? Doesn't he understand what we're doing here? We did it in Afghanistan. We're going to do it in Iraq. Some special forces, some bombing. We're going to take it over. It's going to be like this. He didn't get it. That was the problem. That's why I had to read him out. He wasn't on the team. And so you have a government that basically has been operating since 9/11 very successfully on the principle that if you're with us, you're a genius. If you're against us, you're not just somebody loyal opposition. You're a traitor. It can't deal with you. I'm exaggerating very slightly. So what does that mean? That means no dissent. Somebody I know went recently was working with the Joint Chiefs of Staff on a budget issue. And the budget's in incredible chaos, the Defense Department budget. Don't hold me to this because this isn't, the New Yorker is this great fact-checking system. This is just something I've heard. But among the problems they have, they can't find something like $1 billion in cash that was known to be in Iraq. They just can't find it. And, we're talking with the B word, they're $1 billion. And so they've got huge problems that they're spending. And they were the Joint Chiefs, this is in big league meetings, and then this gentleman has to go and brief his findings. He's an outside expert, done an investigation. He has to brief Rumsfeld. And one of the senior generals, who happens to be a very good guy, not General Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who's known to many generals as hear no evil and see no evil. We have that incredible sort of problem. It's a digression. I wish they had more guts, the 2, 3, and 4 stars. I shouldn't say that because I'm obviously a beneficiary, indirectly. I'm a beneficiary for their thoughts in some cases. But it is sort of sad that none of them have come forward and really blasted away, because I can tell you right now the disaffection inside the Pentagon is really extremely acute. There's never been anything like it. And they feel that this government doesn't care about, a good officer. And I can tell you right now, don't make the mistake of thinking that they're not good people. They are. And in the intelligence service, too, they're people like everybody else. They want to do their job right. They want to do it with as much honor as they can. And this is something that I feel, I know these guys, and they do care. But they also, the good ones also, they're in loco parentis. One of the things they take very seriously, particularly any of you know a Marine, you know what I'm talking about. You give their children to them, they take care of you. They can't do that now in Iraq. and they don't think that they really don't think we care, and they don't think they certainly don't think people in the White House care. So there's a lot of one. You know, we're just beginning a campaign, a political campaign, and we'll get back to it. I don't remember. I lost my thought, but it doesn't matter. Somebody help me out. anyway, so here we are. We have we have a muzzled world. The money story. Somebody listens. So anyway, so one of the good generals, one of the good guys, goes in and there's a meeting with Rumsfeld, and the person I'm talking about is describing the condition that he's discovered of the budget planning. This is, we're talking about lots of billions of dollars. This war is going to probably end up being the $1 trillion war that nobody's, that it's going to, we can't even begin to estimate the cost. We got a lot, you know. When you see the Moore movie, and in Control Room, when you see those movies, the pictures, the photographs that are the most gripping are the photographs of Baghdad before the war. And look, and I know he's a bad guy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Saddam, but still, and the rebuilding. Anyway, the point is that my friend, this person told Rumsfeld how bad things are. Rumsfeld, of course, said in his, oh my God, he said, that's absolutely wrong. He said, there's nothing like that. Then he said, there's no problem with the budget. And he turned to this ranking general and he said, isn't that right? And this general in front of this outsider said, yes, sir, you're right. And that's what happens. That's what you have now. And to me, there's nothing more scary. The Secretary of Defense is simply incapable of hearing what he doesn't want to hear. And he's not the ideologue that Wolfowitz is. You couple that with an ideologue, and I don't know what we can do. I don't know what any of us can do to stop it. I think what's going to happen is the president's, and my guess is, first of all, again, the idea that three networks, or at least two of them, I think, Jenny, I think all three sent their ankle men to Baghdad on the 30th for this transfer of sovereignty. And I just wonder, I mean, how out of touch are they? What sovereignty? What sovereignty do we have to give? There's no phones. There's no electricity. No. This is a sad fact. There is no sovereignty. There's no army. It's a Potemkin village, maybe. Yes. So they're gonna go inside the CPA where the grass is green and the air conditioning works, and they're gonna have a change of command with the press monitoring it. And they had all three anchors there. I thought to myself, wow, it's really scary. we're making the pictures and we're believing them now more than ever. So it doesn't have much reality. So the president's, I would guess, the president's policy is, he doesn't have a policy behind the new government, the Alawi government, which is basically a bunch of outsiders taking control, and everybody's got their hands in certain, there's no way this government's going to be acceptable to anybody except a very small minority of people. It's not going to work. It's not going to stop the insurgency. I think you're going to see a lot of efforts to try and paint the insurgency in the next month as increasingly being outsiders. And I've seen already the first showdown between Al-Qaeda and the United States. Al-Qaeda's taken over the insurgency. I don't think that's true at all. And I can tell you right now, I'm telling you, I know, a year ago, a year and a half ago, there was total panic inside because they were the opposition, the insurgency, was operating in 1-, 2-, and 3-man cells, and we knew nothing about them. I can tell you right now, they're operating 10 and 15-man cells right now, and we still know nothing about them. The interrogations haven't worked, no matter how much pressure they put on people. We have no tactical information of any use whatsoever. And if you go to Europe and talk to some of the intelligence people there and some of the people in the Middle East who are our friends, we have many friends and, you know, are very sad about what's happened to America, are praying for the next election. They will tell you that even this stuff you're hearing about Zakari is Mr. Everybody. He's never liked bin Laden. And it's not clear that the person that we claim responsible for all those acts is he. People who know the Arab world very well and very carefully and listen to his statements. He's a Jordanian. Many of the comments that have alleged to have been in his name are not made by him. In other words, the suggestion is he's a composite figure. He's very convenient. I don't want to suggest to you that we've ever been propagandized by our government, but it's very convenient. It's very convenient to keep on telling the press Zakari's being. My favorite one was that nice kid that was beheaded. Remember, the guy that beheaded him had a hood over and was described very confidently by the American establishment government as Zakari. Well, if they can see through hoods. Anyway, So I think the policy is going to be, we've got this guy, Alawi, and this government. Let's stand him up and see if he can get past the election. And let's just escalate and bomb and bomb and bomb. And the only answer for these guys is going to be more pressure, more military force. They not only do they have to, and, you know, we accept as commonplace every day now. We're emulating Israel and the missile attacks, and it's a daily occurrence. We keep on bombing places in Fallujah, claiming we've gotten rid of Zakaria, who keeps on showing up anyway, whoever he is. We don't have much intelligence, and we're escalating a war. Bombing, missiles, attacks, much more violence. It just has come, crept up on us, you know, a little cat paw. And we're there. We're there in a full-scale, increasingly intense military activity, more bombing, more Air Force planes, more ordnance, more shelling, what we call force protection. That is, you're not going to send troops somewhere where you can just fire a lot of missiles, which means, of course, more collateral damage, more civilians, which means, of course, more opposition, more insurgency, what they did at El Garib and other places was the people they would torture, and sometimes for an Arab man being photographed without clothes on, in the Quran you're not allowed, this side, this front cannot be exposed, and to be exposed that way and to be forced to simulate sexual activity with other males and have women give the thumbs up sign is the ultimate degradation. It's literally any classic definition of it's torture. Torture isn't always physical. It's a torturous process. And the purpose of it, of course, is to generate information. So what do you get? You get people that know nothing. The ICRC, the International Red Cross, estimated in the prison population in El Garib at the time of the worst abuses, they estimated that upwards of 90% had no bearing at all on anything anti-American or any activity that had anything to do with the insurgency. This wonderful General Antonio Taguba, the report that I got, and this guy Taguba's report estimated that 60% had nothing to do. So you take these people, you expose them to the ridicule and physical torture that you can, and they end up telling you that yes, they'll give you the names of people in their neighborhood that are Al Qaeda or terrorists, insurgency, and they give you names, and then of course they're just names, they're just doing it. And then you arrest those people and bring them in, and you start the process. And the circle gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And I would, debating about it, some of the worst things that happen that you don't know about, okay? Videos. There are women there. Some of you may have read that they were passing letters out or communications out to their men. This is in El Garib, which is about 30 miles from Baghdad, 30 kilometers maybe, just 20 miles. I'm not sure whether it's... Anyway, the women were passing messages out, say, please come and kill me because of what's happened. And basically what happened is that those women who were arrested with young boys, children, in cases that have been recorded, the boys were sodomized with the cameras rolling. And the worst above all of them is the soundtrack of the boy shrieking. That your government has. And they were in total terror, it's going to come out. It's impossible to say to yourself, how do we get there? Who are we? Who are these people that sent us there? When I did Milai, I was very troubled, like anybody in his right mind would be, about what happened. And I ended up in something I wrote saying, in the end I said that the people who did the killing were as much victims as the people they killed because of the scars they had. I can tell you some of the personal stories of some of the people are just who were in these units who witnessed this. I can also tell you written complaints were made to the highest officers. And so we're dealing with an enormous, massive amount of criminal wrongdoing that was covered up at the highest command out there and higher. And we have to get to it, and we will. And we will. I mean, you know, it's just, there's enough out there. They can't... So it's going to be an interesting election year. It is. It's going to be Bush versus Bush, I think, largely, in my view. Not that, you know, not that the Democrats won't have, or Ralph Nader won't have something to do with it, but it's really going to be, it's Bush running against Bush. And I don't know where we're going to come out. I guess the only thing I can say is that above and beyond that, all of you know, because all of you care about the constitutional rights and what's going on in the government, the issues that many in this organization are deeply involved in. One of the other great shocking examples of self-censorship or just sheer cowardness or what you will has been the inability of the press corps to deal with the Justice Department and what's happened there. It's one of the great failings. I can tell you the degradation of that place has been so total. And there are people there again. There are many people in those places that really care about human rights. I was getting emails on September the 12th, 2001, from people inside the FBI saying, we are in real trouble with this guy Ashcroft. So there are people there that care. They fight as hard as they can. And it's not as if, when you have the kind of leadership we have, I don't know where we go. I just wish I could tell you, I am telling you, go back, do what you can. When you see these movies, when you see this movie and the other movies, and you'll see them all, you're going to say to yourself, as many people have said to me, I better do more. But also be terribly aware that we are so disconnected with this leadership, it's not necessarily clear that what you do is going to impact on them. Because these are people that are really out there.
You were listening to award-winning investigative journalist Seymour Hersh of The New Yorker speaking on July 7th at the ACLU convention in San Francisco. Thanks to Mike Thornton of KVMR Radio for that recording.
We'll get rid of the dictator, rebuild your country, make sure all your kids go to school. We'll clean up the cities, get the sewage plants running, institute parliamentary rule. We'll bring you autonomy, senators and judges, and a shiny new blue banner. We'll bring you pride and prosperity, food in your bellies, in every home a phone, fax, and scanner. After we torture our prisoners, we'll bring you decades of peace, spiritual release, free religious expression. You can say what you want in the papers you run. We'll never force a confession. After we torture our prisoners, the oil will flow just where it should go, across the desert and into the sea. You'll thank your God and the CIA that finally you are free. After we torture our prisoners, you'll all be safe with us to protect you and keep you out of harm's way. You'll thank creation and your liberation from the dark into a new day. After we torture our prisoners, you can all jump for joy, each girl and boy, and look boldly into the distance. You'll be so happy for all that we've done, for such invaluable assistance. After we torture our prisoners, you won't have to worry about tyrants and bullies. Now that you have sovereignty, you can hold your head high, kiss Saddam goodbye, say hello to democracy. After we torture our prisoners, after we torture our prisoners.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. Last month on the program, we played a series of presentations from the Phase 1 Citizens Inquiry into 9/11 that took place in March in San Francisco. Phase 2, a second conference building on the first, was held in Toronto at the end of May, and we've been able to obtain material from that, which I'll begin to present to you tonight. Some might wonder why this program is devoting so much time to this issue. One simple reason is that there is a virtual blackout on challenges to the official 9/11 story in the U.S. media. But more importantly, the descent of the American state into fascism, bearing only the thinnest veneer of democracy, has all been justified based on the threat to national security in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. The silencing of opposition, under threats by the government that you're with us or with the terrorists, and as we will hear in the presentations that follow, even the cowing of alternative media voices, fearing to lose credibility, quote unquote, by being labeled conspiracy nuts, which serves to suppress legitimate inquiry and citizen demands for accountability. Ian Woods introduces the speaker.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the first of our presentations, which will have panel and questions and answers from the audience. The way that we designed this was so that, based on the history of the San Francisco Phase 1 inquiry, we felt that each speaker deserved more time, and instead of 25 minutes, which was what we were given in San Francisco, that we would have 40 minutes to expound our thesis and give evidence. And the evidence specifically is to refute the official story. Tomorrow morning, we'll review what the official story is at approximately 9:30, for those of you who can catch it. And then you will see where each presenter will attempt to pick holes in it, undermine it, and show, hopefully, by the end of our inquiry, that it is a complete hoax, this official story that the U.S. government has put forward concerning the events surrounding 9/11. So the other thing we want to do is give the presenters a chance to be reviewed by their peers, and hence you see our panelists over here today who are going to be reviewing for only 10 minutes at this point. The next couple of days it'll be a bit longer, but starting off today with just a short panel questions. And then after that, we'll turn it over to you, the audience. Please use the microphone for another 10 minutes of questions and answers. And this was not done in San Francisco. There wasn't enough time on one weekend to facilitate the 30 or so odd presenters. And now we have the luxury of time, so now we've got a chance to really get into the nitty-gritty. And you can help us by thinking about questions as to what is the presenter trying to do to undermine the official story and or, the, in this case, the term conspiracy theory, so that we can present the best evidence possible to our friends, to the media, and maybe later to a tribunal to show without a doubt that the official story is a complete hoax. I'd like to now introduce three of our panelists, of which there are going to be about eight or nine panelists altogether. I will be one of them, the head panelist, and will be giving a report at the end of the conference, just before the town hall on Sunday, for about 20 minutes. We'll give a report as to our findings, and we will encourage then after that all of you to participate in the town hall, which will be 2 or 3 hours of questions to all the presenters, most of whom will be present on the stage at Convocation Hall. But let me start now with our first set of three presenters. We have Norman Thackeray, who's on the right, and Norman is a retired chartered accountant. He's a member of the board of SIFT, which stands for Skeptics Inquiry for Truth, otherwise known as the 9/11inquiry.org group. And he's a newcomer to the movement that brings a fresh point of view to the understanding of 9/11. And then Shirley Farlinger, welcome to the panel, is a longtime peace activist. She is a United Nations rep for Science for Peace. And she's also a member of the Canadian Federation of University Women. She's a member of the United Church of Canada. She has run twice for federal elections on a peace platform, and she is also a new member of the Canadian Pugwash group. And then we have Paul Lacroix, who is a private investigator of international criminal conspiracy, aka conspiracy theorist. So I welcome the panel, our first panel, and wish them luck in finding out the best evidence and what we're lacking in terms of evidence on the official story and how we can deconstruct the term conspiracy theory. And now I'll pass it back to Kelly Reinhart to introduce our speaker. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian. We're going to bring up Jamie Hecht. Jamie is a scholar and an artist living in Brooklyn, New York. He's currently the assistant managing editor at FromTheWilderness.com. His articles on politics, poetry, and the histories of ideas have appeared in a variety of scholarly, literary, and popular journals and periodicals. He has created the first hip-hop tribute to Senator Robert Kennedy. And if you were here last night, you had an awesome opportunity to catch that. Please help me welcome Jamie Hecht.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here, and I thank all the organizers and everyone who's chosen to attend the conference. My topic for today, as you can see, is conspiracy theory and the strange characteristics of this phrase in its career in American discourse, and in fact discourse the world over, but in particular in the psychological manipulation of the American public through the media and through official discourse, and indeed academic discourse as well in the United States. Conspiracy theory clearly is a compound of two words, though it seems to function in the American culture as though it were one word. So in order to try to take it apart, I look at the two elements of it independently. So I want to examine why this phrase is so useful for disinformation, because it's a very reliable workhorse which never gets a moment's rest. In order to do that, I want to distinguish between the street meanings of this term, the meanings which it triggers in the popular imagination, both in general conversations between the mass media and its faceless audience, the kind of audiences which television exists to sell to advertisers, and in the face-to-face conversations that happen in the workplace and at home and in the street, in which I'm sure many, if not all of you, have engaged as activists. You begin to discuss 9/11, and the moment you make it clear that you don't believe the official account, this phrase rises to the fore and intervenes between you and the person to whom you're talking as a kind of screen. And it sets you the task of trying to perforate that screen or somehow get it out of the way so that you can be understood to be a living, thinking, rational human being who actually has a case to make rather than merely a role to play. It's important, therefore, to distinguish between the slang meanings of these two terms and their more formal meanings. Another way of expressing this dichotomy is to say that in any society, there is a culture of orality, of spoken discourse, and a culture of literacy, which involves, includes, and depends upon written sources, and therefore a connection to the past and indeed to other societies. The culture of orality is necessarily local. We need it in order to have identity and feelings of belongingness and social relationships. But if we limit ourselves to it, then we're unable to participate in a more masterful discourse, which enables us to identify with persons who live elsewhere in space and before and after us in time. Only writing can do that. And the fact that nobody has time to read a book in a country where everybody has to put in all of her time and energy making a living, and there's no childcare, and there's no universal health care, and you just don't have the time and energy to try to participate in governing your own affairs in a democratic polity. It's very easy to short-circuit people's efforts to read the information which is already out there, so that people tend to assume there is no information out there. It seems to me what we need to do, one way of explaining to ourselves and each other our task, is that we need to help other people get this phrase, conspiracy theory, out of the way, either by persuading people that it's worse than useless, or by cleansing it of the social stain with which it has been afflicted, and making the phrase our own. I think those are two acceptable strategies. The street or mainstream meaning of conspiracy is that it just refers to what happens when corrupt officials cooperate with each other to do something illegal. Now, this leaves out the fact that often conspiratorial, harmful activity, which results in theft, fraud, deception, murder, grief, and bereavement, is not, in fact, illegal. Often, as Claudius says in Shakespeare's Hamlet, the wicked prize itself buys out the law. You can so pay off the legislative and even executive and judicial branches of the United States government that your nefarious activities no longer contravene the legal system. So it is, it seems to me, with tort reform. One of Ralph Nader's crusades has been to try to arrest the process whereby environmentally reckless corporations, and corporations which do other various kinds of harm to the public, and I'll turn to one of them in a moment, make legal precisely those activities. So that's one of the limitations. It's not just illegal stuff that constitutes conspiracy. Another limitation is that it's not just officials who engage in conspiratorial and harmful behavior. The next term is theory. People in the street suppose that theory is the opposite of certainty. This is worse than useless. It's profoundly misleading, and it has very important effects on our effort to educate ourselves and the public, and therefore to wrest away from elites their monopoly upon the freedom to persuade and to suggest. People figure that a theory is an educated guess about something nobody can fully understand anyway. Since nobody can fully understand it, any argument is just a guess. And if you feel passionately about your own guesses, why, that's crazy, solipsistic narcissism. This is why we, about as often as we hear the phrase conspiracy theorist, we hear the phrase conspiracy nut, conspiracy buff, as though Albert Einstein were a physics buff. Walt Whitman, a poetry buff. Thomas Jefferson was a big government hobbyist. The street meaning of the phrase conspiracy theory is that it's a passionate guess about why bad things happen, and it's a guess that blames people in government. Conspiracy is popularly regarded as a term for things that happen rarely. Some strange, exceptional episode in which people who are normally dutiful public servants who follow the shining star of their sworn duty somehow are seduced by the devil and engage in some nefarious activity, hoping that others won't discover it. In fact, in an article that I wrote for From the Wilderness, Mike Rupert's extraordinary website, of which I've lately been honored to serve as the assistant managing editor, I wrote an article called Richard Clark's Orchestra. Maestro plays a simple waltz. Hobbled media managed to dance along. I pointed out that in Clark's book, he claims, quite transparently, I think, and I think he wants it to be transparent, that conspiracy theorists make two incompatible errors. One is to believe that the government is so incompetent that it can fail to find facts which the independent researchers discover. And the other is that the government is so skilled and competent that it can prevent any information from leaking out. This is absurd on at least two counts. The first is that the incompetence explanation is the government's hypothesis. It's not our hypothesis. Our hypothesis is that conspirators who are part of official bodies like the military are in fact venal and transgressive and willing to ruin other people's lives and destroy their families by inflicting grief and bereavement and loss, hunger, and the squandering of human potential. Not that they're incompetent. That's the mainstream account. Clark's other point is that we fools here on the margin are persuaded that the government is successful at keeping all the information to itself, so that we dissenters are engaging in an act of faith of some kind. Instead, it's the case
that we depart from the mainstream in believing that the reams of information emitted by the government and by business elites who collaborate with them in the kind of nefarious activities which it is our job to discuss and to investigate might be important to look at. That the stacks, floor to ceiling, of documents released through the Freedom of Information Act, through litigation, through the deliberate leaks of heroic whistleblowers like Daniel Ellsberg and Colleen Rowley, and the list goes on and on, though perhaps not as long as it should, are actually worth our attention. Furthermore, one of the remarkable characteristics of the 9/11 movement, even more than other older strains of the political justice movement, like the truth for the JFK murder movement, is that the mainstream media let slip, sometimes accidentally and sometimes through the genuine, if repressed, courage of journalists here and there, so much valuable information, which people like Paul Thompson and Nafiz Ahmed and Michael Rupert and Barry Zwicker and others with whom we're honored to share this room, have collected. And it's much more difficult, of course, for the public to dismiss information which has appeared in the media venues which they traditionally trust. Greg Palast says, people tell me they don't believe in conspiracy. I tell them, look, I have the minutes of the meetings. What more do you want? I adore that. John Judge says, call me a conspiracy theorist if you like, so long as you call yourself, you call everybody else a coincidence theorist. And Phil Berg has reminded everybody that in the Criminal Code of the United States, this term has a function, which is worked and used every day in thousands of court cases across the United States. Conspiracy is popularly understood to apply exclusively to crimes of government elites involving rare and exceptional episodes of illegal conduct. Such crimes, however, are usually expressions of systemic and ongoing relationships between those elites and the criminal elements they are supposed to hinder and punish, the criminal elements whom they have sworn to hinder and punish. Richard Clark called his book Against All Enemies. I think this book is a strange species of limited hangout, one which Clark wrote in order to affect the debate and put pressure on the administration without doing what Pierre Salinger did in the TWA Flight 800 episode, where he ran screaming, the official story is a lie, and he was instantly marginalized as a, yeah. And then the media became blind and deaf to what he had to say. Clark was much more careful. I think Clark is motivated by his personal loss of his friend John O'Neill, with whom I'm sure you're familiar, the maverick FBI agent who acted in good faith until he perished along with 3,000 other New Yorkers on the 11th of September. He called it Against All Enemies, and that phrase comes from the oath of office, to uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Well, since the book alleged incompetence, presumably it was accusing the administration of failing to defend the United States against foreign enemies. But the phrase says foreign and domestic, and the book is aimed at the Bush administration and its failures. And therefore, it can be understood to be against all enemies, and therefore against domestic enemies. Now, why would the Bush administration be talked about as domestic enemies? Not domestic fools or frauds, some kind of bumbling non-entities who, like George Bush the First, were somehow out on the golf course, you know, mesmerized with his own leisure, while the Iran-Contra crimes were being committed, and ladies and gentlemen and kids were bleeding to death in Latin America because of his enterprise. No, these were domestic enemies. And for instance, narco-traffickers, money launderers, these are people with whom official elites often cooperate. Conspiracy is rarely used to denote crimes of non-governmental elites, and I give an example below, which are far more numerous. and more open to public scrutiny through litigation, because when you sue Exxon, they can't shout national security. For instance, the Ford Firestone episode. Remember that one? In which a corporate board of directors secretly conducted a cost-benefit analysis which concluded that a timely recall of Ford's defective tires would cost more revenue, even though it would save lives, it would cost them more money than the penalties incurred in the projected number of post-fatality lawsuits. So we know that our tires aren't reliable, but we won't recall them. We'll continue to sell them to the public because few enough people will die so that when their families sue us, we can simply award them damages, and the sum of those damages is likely to be less than the amount of money it would cost us to recall the damn tires. And yet, persons who participate in this sort of thing are capable of sleeping at night. And this is, I think, not only a political problem and a cultural problem, but a psychologically fascinating one. And it's for that reason that after I talk about conspiracy for a little bit, time permitting, I've set up the second half of my presentation to concentrate on the psychology of these episodes. The formal meaning of conspiracy, this is rather fascinating, comes from the U.S. Criminal Code 8.18. It's from the Ninth Circuit. But I'll just read the large stuff. You have to establish that the defendant directly conspired with one or more conspirators to carry out at least one of the objects of the conspiracy. But look at the second sentence in the first paragraph of small print. It is not necessary that all members of the conspiracy join it at the same time, and one may become a member of a conspiracy without full knowledge of all the details of the unlawful scheme or the names, identities, or locations of the other members, so that when Chauncey Holt is assigned the duty of forging 15 sets of fake Secret Service credentials for use on the grassy knoll in order to turn back the public as they rush up the hill trying to find out who just murdered the American Republic and ushered in the Vietnam War, which will cause the death of 2.2 million Vietnamese and 58,000 American kids. Run up the hill and you're told, you better turn back, you might get shot or killed, close quote. Chauncey Holt, who forged those 15 sets of Secret Service credentials, had no idea who the shooters were, didn't know where the assassins came from or how they got them out of the country. But he did his piece, and it's a compartmentalized operation, and that is why it succeeded. So it is with 9/11. You have to prove that the defendant knew that other people were involved with the people whom the defendant knew. And you got to prove that the defendant was going to benefit. Now, to switch from conspiracy to theory, theory is from the ancient Greek verb theorein, from which we get the form theater. It is a kind of watching. It is an overview of the workings and the nature of a domain. In science, a scientific theory observes the workings of a domain within nature. And the domain outside of science can be one found in art or society. It's popularly regarded, however, as a term implying unverified and even unverifiable assumptions, the opposite of fact. Whereas in actuality, facts only mean something as tiles in a mosaic that configures a picture. If instead these facts, or as we call them with appropriate contempt, factoids, don't cohere into a coherent picture from which it's possible for a rational observer to infer a general account of how things go, then they are meaningless. Data in a table presented to a non-specialist have no meaning. A theory organizes the facts into a coherent whole.